This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Amy Bloom, says The New Yorker, gets more meaning into individual sentences than most authors manage in whole books. The author of 5 short story collections and 2 works of nonfiction, including a memoir, she has only written 5 novels since she debuted in 1997 with Love Invents Us. I interviewed Amy Bloom for her 2nd novel, Away, on October 4th, 2007, which we hear today. I would interview her 7 years later for her 3rd novel, Lucky Us. Her most recent novel, I'll Be Right Here, was published in June 2025. Amy Bloom, your latest book, Away, concerns a woman named Lillian Lieb, a refugee from the Ukraine, who comes to America in 1924 and takes a road trip. According to what I've read, this is actually based on a true story of a woman named Lillian Ayling.
There doesn't seem to be any real evidence that anybody named Lillian Ayling ever existed. There's no Ayling that ever came through on Ellis Island. You know, what you have are a couple of enterprising journalists during what I think of as the golden age of yellow journalism, where you could also write about the Loch Ness Monster and people who were 11 feet tall and, you know, make up entire wars if that was necessary to sell newspapers. And so you do see that there are some pictures of somebody whom they call Lillian Ayling, although there's no evidence that that was her name, because the other thing that the newspapers say is she didn't speak any English and she never spoke to anybody. And so I think the sight of a woman traveling by herself in that part of the world in the mid-1920s stimulated a lot of curiosity. And the curiosity led to stories, sort of much in the same way that you hear about the alligators in the sewers of New York.
And how did you hear about Lillian Ayling?
I heard about Lillian Ayling because my father was a journalist and a great collector of minor and odd facts. He was the kind of man given to saying things like, "You know, honey, there are only 6 blacksmiths left in Illinois." And he also said to me, "Ah, that story about the woman who walked to Russia, what a nut." And that stayed with me. And I thought, well, if you weren't a nut, why might you do that? What would prompt you to make that trip?
So at what point did you consider this becoming your 2nd novel? And how did that come about?
Well, I did pursue sort of the facts of the story, of which there were very few.
But so it had stuck in your head?
It had stuck in my head since I was a kid, actually. My family are Russian Jews on both sides. My parents were both first-generation Americans. And I found myself thinking, you know, as Willa Cather says, there are only 5 human stories. What's astonishing is how often they repeat themselves. And it's sort of the same thing with the heart of any plot. The heart of any plot, it seems to me, is I go on a journey or a stranger comes to town. And I thought, I would like to do a story in which I do both. And it did occur to me at some point, I mean, Lillian just sort of appeared to me, I could sort of see what she was like, but it did occur to me in passing that in terms of world literature, we were perhaps a little short on the woman being the stranger who comes to town, as opposed to the lady standing in the town square welcoming the hero.
You began your research, and I understand you worked up a 40-page outline before you really got going. Is that right?
Well, I did. I needed a rope. This was a kind of mountain I hadn't climbed before, and I really felt like I needed something to hang on to. And even though I made changes in the outline as I went along, it was very useful to me to have a path.
She starts in New York, goes to Seattle, goes to Prince Rupert, and at some point toward the end, she winds up in Dawson. Was that part of the original outline? Was that part of the Lillian Ayling story?
Well, the Lillian Ayling story basically consists of somebody who suddenly shows up in Canada on the Collins Oral and Telegraph Trail and makes her way to Dawson. Those are the 2 sightings that are reported. So there wasn't anything about her life in America prior to that. But I knew certainly what my grandparents' path had been and how that had come about and how it comes about for so many people. I mean, I think that the story of immigrants who are both hopeful and despairing and have already suffered great loss coming to this country goes to almost every ethnic group, right up to people arriving right this minute at the airport.
She comes from an area around Pripyat, which is in the Ukraine today. It's actually the river that Chernobyl
all of the detritus from Chernobyl washes away from. Is that where your family's from?
No, actually, they're not. But in that area, which is also often known as sort of the Pale of Settlement, I wanted a name that I could pronounce during readings, and I wanted an area that I had a physical sense of. And although I'm much more familiar with the St. Petersburg area of Russia, this struck me as a suitable place. And I also wanted a place that was not too big. I didn't want her to be, you know, from Krakow or from Vilna. I wanted her to be from a small town.
It makes sense. The Ukrainians then and now are notoriously anti-Semitic.
Well, yes, although I would say that there's, a fair amount of competition for second and third place in that contest.
The book, it's been compared to two novels and one nonfiction book, and I'm going to ask you about whether these books played any role in terms of your thoughts about it. One is Ragtime, one is Cold Mountain, The Search, and the third is Irving Howe's World of Our Fathers.
It's not a bad day when those are the books you get compared to. I read World of Our Fathers, 15, 20 years ago, and I don't think I've actually looked at it since, but it certainly made an impression on me at the time. I'm a huge fan of Ed Doctorow's. I'm a huge fan of everything that he writes. And I have to say, I hadn't read Cold Mountain.
But you saw the movie?
I did see the movie, and I thought, boy, she looks good. She's a lovely-looking woman, but you do find yourself thinking, gosh, I wonder where the spa was.
In making a movie of a way, one of the problems, I think, is in creating somebody who could be beautiful and bedraggled at the same time.
I think that's true. And the fact is, I don't think of Lillian as beautiful. I think of her as attractive. I think of her as compelling and interesting and having the kind of quality that makes you interested in seeing what's going to happen next. And certainly she is not pretty. I think she's one of those people who can be beautiful and sometimes probably quite plain. But what she is not is, adorable.
Let's talk about some of her stops along the way. The research into the Yiddish theater, the Goldfaden Theater, Reuben Burstein and Meyer Burstein, father and son, are those based on real people?
They are not based on real people, although the name Burstein is certainly a shout out to Pesacha Burstein, who was a sort of matinee idol and a man of sort of tremendous sort of elegance and charm in the Yiddish theater, who worked rather later than the novel is set. They're just sort of made out of my imagination. But there are wonderful archives of the Yiddish theater. My great aunt and uncle were sort of patrons of the Yiddish opera, which is, I would say, Yiddish theater's slightly more eccentric cousin.
The business about King Lear being played by a woman?
That's actually true. It is called The Woman in the Moon, and it is King Lear, absolutely. But for whatever reason, the people writing the script at the time, and these scripts tend to be written on napkins and then performed, a few weeks later, felt that it wasn't quite compelling enough with the father and the daughters. They wanted the mother and the daughters, and a lot of rending of garments. They took wonderful liberties. I mean, they really did. They felt that Romeo and Juliet, although compelling, needed a lot more of the nurse for comic relief. And it was also the case that people switched around the speeches, and so that if you were in the middle of Macbeth but felt that things really weren't going well, you could just bring in Hamlet's soliloquy. I changed the name and disguised everything and gave credit when they absolutely had to, but I think they observed, as Shakespeare did, that there was nothing new under the sun and a story was a story.
When you're trying to get the realism so that you are there with Lillian on her journey, it also means trying to get the wording right,
yes.
How they spoke. How did you work on getting the dialogue so that it was authentic to the era, and particularly the cliches?
Well, part of what one forgets is that, the 20s was the modern world. Many of the expressions we use were already in use. I did have somebody say to me, I find it very hard to believe that a young woman in the 1920s would have a glass of wine by herself. And I thought, really? I mean, what do you think? It's Masterpiece Theater, Coronation Street. I mean, people lived their lives, They ate and they drank and they had sex and they had children and they had fights and they had difficulties, and they moved very much as we do. I mean, they moved by car and by train, and they moved quickly, and they had celebrity endorsements and tabloids and, corrupt government and unknown sources of funding for all sorts of activities in the wider world, and everybody knew it. They were not fools, and they were not innocents. They were people just like us.
They also had silent and early talkie films,
yes.
Particularly the Yiddish theater did.
Yes, they did, which are extraordinary to watch. I think that in general, in terms of language, what I mean, I did do a lot of checking on American slang and things like that. But the other thing that marks a lot of the speech is where people come from. I know that I am a different person in Italian than I am in English, because my Italian is just not as sophisticated. And so I wanted the language in the dialogue to reveal things like how long people had been in the country, what they were learning, what they knew, what they were going on to be able to say and express. And you also get that in the Yiddish theater. You get people who were trained in a sort of very formal 19th century style of theater coming up now against the young stars of the Yiddish theater who are much more interested in the naturalistic style.
When you're developing your research on a book like this and you've got your outline so you kind of know where you're going, I've talked to different writers. I get two different perspectives. One is, I don't really care about the accuracy as long as it feels true. And the other says, I do care about the accuracy, even if it may not feel true, because it's accurate. Where do you sit?
I suspect I like both. I like to know what is factually correct. And if it doesn't feel true, or it makes the sentence awkward, or it doesn't work with my plot, I won't change it necessarily, but I might abandon that particular fact. There aren't that many facts that are actually essential to telling any particular story. But, you know, if I'm going to have an animal in Alaska, I want it to be an animal that appears in Alaska. You know, I don't want it to be a leopard, because that would be a different kind of book, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just then you're choosing to write a different kind of book.
There's a small piece about being gay in New York at that particular time, being
yes.
a gay man. Where did that research come from?
Oh, they're just some wonderful books, both primary and secondary texts of sort of the gay culture in New York in the 20s, all of which was fascinating. I could have done an entire separate book, both in the places and the culture and what was open and what was closed and the openly gay nightclubs that catered to heterosexual couples in much the same way that Harlem catered to white people with money. It was an extraordinary and interesting time. And people who lived those lives went to a lot of trouble to keep memoirs and journals, and I am grateful to them. And people did some wonderful books on them.
When writing a character like Lillian, you've been a practicing psychologist for 20 years now. You've also written this book, Normal, which is about fish out of water, transgender people in a non-transgender society. What role do you think the research and your background played? Because she is a fish out of water.
I don't know how many of us are not fish out of water at some point or another. You know, it may be that, you know, for most people, their life struggle is to try and find the water. I think the things that drew me to become a therapist are probably the things that also drive me to write and explore character, which is that I'm interested in people's natures, and I am interested in how what they do reveals who they are. Because it is my belief, absolutely, that what happens to you does not make you who you are once you are an adult. It just shows who you are.
Lillian moves on to Seattle, and we have another section involving life in Seattle among prostitutes. Again, the research. Are there books about the late 20s jazz era?
Absolutely. I mean, it was not the jazz era in Seattle, I can tell you that. But yes, there were some wonderful texts, especially about the African-American community in Seattle, which had been a sort of burgeoning middle-class community. And then as you reach that tipping point in which there are slightly more African-American people than white people are comfortable with, all of a sudden the town becomes very racist. And having been completely integrated, it becomes, you know, a community of apartheid, which was not uncommon in America. And in terms of, you know, how prostitutes live their lives, I guess, you know, there were enough texts for me to look at, but also I don't think it requires extraordinary acts of imagination to get the idea that this is your job, people give you money for it, and presumably you have several different kinds of feelings about it.
One of the interesting elements of the book, and I don't know how conscious this is that Lillian is kind of a blank slate coming to America. But not really. I mean, she's got a rather severe background. But she learns. She learns how to relate. And I'm just curious, how conscious was the transformation of Lillian, or did it just happen organically as you were writing the book?
Well, it did happen organically. I wasn't that conscious of it, but it is clear to me that this book is very much about becoming an American and about coming back to life. It's interesting to me because I don't think of her as blank at all when she comes to this country, but she is deeply traumatized and does not reveal much. Because the truth is, I think when you have suffered those kinds of grievous losses, you cannot keep looking at them because you will simply lie down and die. And so people, I think you see this in soldiers. I think you see this in people who've been through, you know, really terrible circumstances. They just draw a veil over it. And for some people, the veil is charming. And for some people, the veil is prickly. But there is definitely a curtain over it.
She also winds up in Prince Rupert. Have you been up there?
I haven't been to Prince Rupert, I have to say. I have actually been to a lot of Canada, and I had been to Alaska several times. So I felt that I could probably get away with Prince Rupert without actually going to town.
She winds up in a prison at one point, Hazleton.
Yes, well, it's not really a prison, it's a work farm. I mean, I only said that not to suggest that she is free to come and go, only that it is not for people, by and large, who have committed crimes against other people. It is crimes of property, by and large, and crimes of attitude. These are not murderers.
What was the point of putting her there, to keep her there for the winter, the same reason that Arthur Gilpin put her there?
Absolutely, just so that, because I did not think she was going to make it through a winter. This woman was not a trapper or a trekker. I thought, she's not going to make it through this, and either she's going to live with Arthur as his maid, which I thought she would find unbearable, or she would be sent away for her own good.
Is that pretty much how a lot of these choices are made? I have a quote from you. The only reason you like to reread your old stuff is because you could see where you solved the problem, and you can also see where you kind
failed
of didn't.
Failed to solve the problem. Yeah. I think that's true. I think, you know, there were times where I spent a lot of time going, what would Lillian do? If I were Lillian and this was my choice, I thought, she is so pigheaded and she is so determined. She's going to go out and try to do this. And there were suggestions in the little news clips of the Lillian Ailing story. There were suggestions that at one point she was arrested for carrying a crowbar as a concealed weapon. And as far as you could tell, it sounded like she spent like two nights in the county jail. But it did seem to me likely that in some important ways, not really knowing the rules and having some English and no power and no resources, I thought, well, how would she stay out of a place like, I mean, sooner or later, she's going to make a mistake in judgment. Sooner or later, she's not going to quite understand what the rules are.
The only problem that I had with the search, I guess it's not something that you necessarily had to solve, Amy Bloom, but it's that she's on a trek to Siberia to find her daughter. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, okay, she can get to Siberia. How the hell in all of Siberia or Tikhonaya is she going to find her daughter?
Well, I think that when you say that, you are acting as if I've told you I'm going on vacation in Umbria, but I'm not making reservations. How do you think that will be working out with the hotels? I think this is somebody who has no place in the world. What she really feels is she might as well die trying to find her child as go on being half alive in New York for the rest of her life. I think she hopes for the best. I mean, there isn't any suggestion that she knows exactly how to do this, only that it has occurred to her where she thinks her daughter is likely to be. And I will say, from the factual point of view, had she gotten to that part of Siberia, then she probably would have found her daughter had they been there, because it wasn't that big a community. The fact that she was, as they say, essentially misinformed about what that trip would be like strikes me as anybody else who doesn't really speak the language and doesn't have the resources. One is more likely to be misinformed than not.
You did go to Dawson.
I did. The Telegraph Trail, part of what was so interesting to me is that although Lillian does it with some difficulty and she does about 20 miles a day, there were a number of people. The Telegraph Trail was really only useful for about 25, 30 years. It had a very small window of being of any use to anybody before the radio came in. But the guys who were up there, the telegraph operators, did try to keep each other entertained. And the fact is that people hiked it for pleasure, or for sport, I should say, as well as out of necessity. And so there were a number of women, I mean, you know, not hundreds, but certainly dozens, who hiked that trail in its entirety, the 300 miles, very comfortably. When I say comfortably, I don't mean, you know, it was plush or it was posh, but they managed it and they didn't die and they lived to write about it and tell their grandchildren about it. So part of what that revealed to me is it really could be done. And you did not have to be a professional outdoors person to do it. You just had to be in reasonably good shape and prepared to do a lot of walking.
There's a short piece about meeting some children and their father. Mm-hmm. How did that come to you?
I just really could see them. And there were a lot of stories that one would encounter in Alaska of children whose mothers or fathers had to leave them to go get stuff out of the trap or to fish or to, you know, to do a life or death sort of activity. And there were a number of these sort of small self-published memoirs of the period that, you know, my brother and I were left alone, you know, in the back of the general store for 3 weeks while my dad had to go away, or my mom died in childbirth and my father had to do this, or my dad was gone and my mother had to walk 200 miles to get the doctor, things like that. It's that kind of place in the world. It's not comfortable and it's not easy. It's not comfortable and easy even now, and people do what they must do. And so I could just really see these three little kids and thought about the possibilities that that would raise for Lillian.
There's an omniscient point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You're switching around between point of views, though most of it is Lillian. But what distinguishes the book, and it's fairly early on, is that once somebody leaves Lillian's life, you tell the rest of their story.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty unusual. And how did you come to that decision?
I think I came to it because I love 19th century literature. I really do. I grew up as a kid reading Dickens, and I loved the epilogue. That's always seemed to me to be a gift. What I had wanted with this book was to write what I think of now as sort of a 21st century, 19th century novel, in which I could move around in space and time and in people's psyches in a way that you didn't in the 19th century novel, but nevertheless have something that was dense and alive with character and plot. I love knowing what happens to people before they come and after they go. I really like that. And it is also, I think, you know, my great affection for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. The idea that nobody is a minor character in their own play, only in our plays, you know. The person who sells you the loaf of bread is the lead in the man who sells the loaf of bread story. And we are just minor supporting characters as the customers. And that idea stayed with me, and this seemed a way to be able to stay connected to everybody even though they have to come and go.
Were there any characters, I mean, it's the illusion that the character takes over, but were there any characters who either in a way pushed themselves more into the narrative or pretty much said to you, and we're using said in really big quotes, what their life story would be afterward?
I think the strongest example of that was Chinky Chang, who's a grifter that Lillian encounters at the work farm. I had not intended to give her history and her future. And that was actually the first, that part of the book wasn't written in chronological order. So Chinky was really sort of the first character with whom that happened. But I could just see it. I could see her father and her family and the man that she falls in love with and her whole life. And I thought, oh, well, I can see her whole life. I guess I'll write that story.
Amy Bloom, your previous work was called Normal, which was about transgender people.
Not just about transgender people, it's also about heterosexual cross-dressers and people who are intersexed.
Okay.
And I only say that because it's a slightly wider array.
What prompted you to write that book?
I had written some fiction for The New Yorker, and Tina Brown was at that time the editor, and she said, wasn't there some nonfiction you'd like to do for us? And I said, well, I like to play tennis, and I like to garden, and there was a terrible silence at the other end of the phone. And she said, mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, I've always wondered why you don't see anything about female-to-male transsexuals. And she said, there's an idea. And so I did a lot of research on that, and that was one chapter in the book, one essay. And then it led me to think about really sort of issues of gender and culture more than just sort of medical circumstances, but sort of how people understand their gender and also why we care so much.
Why do you think we do?
Well, I think everybody likes to know something. And one of the things that we feel we should be able to know immediately and surely and immutably is somebody's gender. And the fact that this stuff is so much more fluid than we like to think, and that anybody we know can be dramatically changed by 6 months of hormones of the opposite sex, just makes us all nervous. It feels like everything is on casters and all the furniture can slide from one side of the room to the other at a moment's notice. So I think it has to do with that. And it is, as I said in the book, it's as if you live during the period of Galileo And the church is saying, no, no, we insist that you agree that everything circles around the earth. And all the scientists go, all right, everything circles around the earth except Galileo, who says, you know, and yet.
Gore Vidal once made the comment when asked if he was gay. He said, you know, gay doesn't exist for me. I just have homosexual acts. There are no homosexuals or heterosexuals. Yet at the same time, a lot of people make it their business to say who they are, to confirm a particular identity. Do you think Vidal is wrong? Do you think he's right?
People do seem to make quite a big deal of announcing who they are. One has only to look at the wedding section of any newspaper to discover that people seem to have a very strong wish to announce what their sexual orientation is one way or another. I will say that in my experience, there certainly are a great many things about having your sexual orientation be towards somebody of the same sex and the opposite sex that can certainly frame somebody's life, and the cultural hostility to it even more frames and shapes one's life and experience. But it is also true that in terms of my own relationships with people and my own observations, gender trumps orientation every time. Men are men are men. Women are women are women. I think that people's sexual thoughts, if not their sexual acts, to go back to Gore Vidal's distinction, are much wider ranging than they tend to acknowledge in public, which is perfectly understandable. That the spectrum of human sexuality is always broader than people like to take into account. I talked to a doctor of biology, a really well-known researcher named Mickey Diamond, who's at the University of Hawaii. And what he said to me one time is he said, it's like this, sweetheart. Culture hates variety. Nature loves it. And I think it is that way for sexuality as well.
Amy Bloom, let's talk for a second about State of Mind with Lily Taylor. How did this come about? How did you get involved in doing a TV show?
Greer Shepherd and Mike Robin, who were the producers for The Closer and the producers for Nip Tuck, liked my fiction and called and wanted to know if I had any bright ideas for a TV show. And I said I didn't think so. And then I thought about it some more and I said, well, what I always like is backstage. And it seems to me nobody's ever written backstage with a bunch of therapists from the therapist's point of view. I mean, they show therapists, but clearly those therapists are always written by people who are patients, not people who are therapists. I said, so it might be nice to see it from the therapist's point of view.
What involvement have you had with the series?
It's not even a mom and pop show. It's really, as Greer and I called it, the mom and mom show, because Mike has been doing a lot of The Closer and Nip Tuck. So we didn't even have a showrunner. It was basically me and Greer going blue shoes, not red shoes, tall, not short. This is the tone of that scene. So I was the head writer. We just parceled out the scripts to a couple of other writers that we liked and felt comfortable with. I wrote three of the scripts. I would say Greer and I did everything but make the corned beef sandwiches.
Did you have anything to do with choosing directors, being on set?
One of us was on set every day, just about 16 hours a day.
How did that feel? Did you feel like, oh, I've got to intrude, I've got to stand back? I mean, what was your own feeling about it?
It depended. When we did the pilot, I certainly stood back a lot more because I didn't know that much. Once you get underway, though, you realize that the continuity comes from the writers and the cast. Because, you know, in television, it's a different director every episode. Although we were lucky enough to have Arvin Brown twice, and we were lucky enough to have the wonderful Adam Arkin and David Petrarca, who was enormously talented. So we had great people, and they were people who wanted to talk about things. They wanted a collaborative vision, and they also wanted to know what our perspective on the show was over the long term. So I feel like we had wonderful possibilities and very good outcomes and great editors.
How did Lily Taylor become involved?
Lily was interested in the part. We had met a little bit. She knew my work. I knew her work. She was in New York at the time, and she drove up to my house in Connecticut, and we had lunch, and she read a couple of the speeches, and we thought, oh, good, look at us. We're in business. Let's put on a show.
And did Lifetime approach you? You approached Lifetime at a certain point?
Lifetime had a period of wishing to, as they say, rebrand, where they did not want to be known as the network for women. They wanted to go in a very different direction. They wanted to have more sophisticated programming. I think they really hoped that they might become more like FX or TNT. I don't know that that's still their view. But at the time, they were really open to different kinds of work, and they were very enthusiastic about the project.
And how many episodes? There were 8 episodes there?
That's it.
That's it?
It was a short order, partially because I had to finish teaching. I couldn't get out there until the middle of May.
Are there going to be more shows, or is this it?
Oh, gosh, I guess you'd have to ask Lifetime.
So you don't know one way or the other.
I actually don't know.
Do you have any other projects in mind in terms of that?
Not in terms of Lifetime. I have a screenplay that I need to deliver by Christmas. I have two film adaptations I would like to do, not from my work, from other people's work. And then we'll see what happens with Away.
A couple of quick questions. Teaching creative writing, can you really teach it, and what can you teach?
Well, I think, yes, you can teach it in the same way that you can teach somebody Italian. You can't teach them to be Dante. You know, you can teach somebody how to recognize a better sentence and a worse sentence, and you can encourage them to practice being an intelligent reader and an intelligent writer so that they develop craft. You can encourage experience, you can encourage practice and revision, and you can encourage respect for the craft. You cannot teach or give talent.
The Sopranos was based in part on the story of a psychoanalyst speaking with Tony Soprano. When you watched those, and I'm sure you did at one point or another, what was your feeling about Dr. Melfi?
Well, I'm a big fan of the actress. I felt that the beginning was quite interesting. I certainly understood that it was necessary that she should make a lot of mistakes for the purposes of plot. But, you know, certainly I don't have a large poster of Dr. Melfi, you know, in my office, you know, with a little note underneath from me saying, my hero.
Did you feel it was true to life, that a psychologist would function in that way?
Well, of course it's true to life. You know, there are just as many incompetent psychotherapists as there are incompetent plumbers. It's not like there's something about becoming a therapist that you can say, oh, a therapist would never do that. A therapist, it's a job, people. It's not a personality.
Amy Bloom, you're working on another novel, too?
Not yet. I don't start till January.
Is that novel going to be, again, a complete departure? Do you have any idea what you're doing? You have a 40-page outline yet?
I don't have the outline yet. I haven't had time to sit down with my favorite grad student and have him take out his computer and me open a bottle of wine and get to work on it. But I'm looking forward to it. That's going to be January 3rd as far as I'm concerned.
And Away, any interest from Hollywood yet? The reviews have been spectacular. So.
People make noise, and so we'll see when the smoke settles what there is.
Can you see yourself writing the screenplay?
Sure. I think before they fire me and hire yet another person to write the screenplay, I'd like a crack at it.
And you've said you do not want a famous person in the lead.
Well, I don't mind a famous person. I just don't want somebody who is completely ill-suited to it. You know, there are a lot of wonderful actresses out there, some famous, some not so famous. What I really meant was that I did not want somebody glossy and lovely with bright white teeth and beautifully done hair schlepping through the tundra.
You've been listening to a Bookwaves archive interview with novelist and short story writer Amy Bloom, recorded in the KPFA studios on October 4th, 2007, while she was on tour for her second novel, Away. Her most recent novel, I'll Be Right Here, was published in June 2025. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.